Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. The name Baron Gift Collier is one many Southwest Floridians know. He's the man who was one of the area's biggest landowners and a man for whom Collier County is named. But there is more to his story, and it's all in a new book by Maria Repko, who is in the studio with us. Maria, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm very glad to be able to talk about Baron Collier.
So there may be a perception about Baron Collier that he's a well-heeled man who may have been born wealthy, but that's really not the case. You start your book at the very beginning. Tell me about how he started out.
Well, he was born in Memphis, and he was the youngest of four children. His father was actually an artist, very talented. But Baron Collier went to the local school, and he left when he was 16. They didn't have any money or anything. He got a job selling freight for the railway system. And he got bored with doing that. So he found some gas streetlights and decided that that would be a good thing to sell or to install in areas where there was no electricity. Now, Collier was born in 1873. And so this was in the early 1890s. When electricity wasn't that widespread. Anyway, he got the franchise for the gas streetlights, and he got his first contract, and he had to fill up the gas tanks, and then he hired a whole bunch of kids who were not that much younger than he was to go around and turn them on at night, and then in the morning to turn them all off. And that was part of his contract with the city.
So he had to make sure those gas tanks were filled. That's kind of a hustle. That's a lot of work.
It was a lot of work, a lot of responsibility for a youngster who was less than 20. But he was an entrepreneur. He just had a knack of doing business. And he sold his gas streetlights in all kinds of places, including Richmond, Virginia, and stuff like that. I mean, he traveled all around, went to New Orleans and things. But, of course, electricity spread. And there was less and less need for the gas streetlights.
But like any good businessman, he was ready to roll with the changes. And then streetcars came along.
That's right. And, of course, there were streetcars that were drawn by horses. But as soon as electric streetcars came along, they were clean. I won't say they weren't noisy, but they didn't leave droppings.
There's that.
There was advertising in the streetcars, but it was behind glass, all the advertising posters. The glass got dirty, of course. They were all different sizes. Nobody bothered to change them, so half the time they were out of date. You couldn't have a Christmas advertisement and still have it up in June. So he decided, let's make frames that are all the same size. And we can print cardboard, put those in the frames, and then make sure that we change them often as need be.
And those were on the exterior of the streetcars?
It was on the inside.
Oh, on the inside, okay.
On the inside. If you think about the subway in New York, there's posters inside, isn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, certainly.
It's definitely up above the heads.
Yeah, above your head.
But he ended up in New York, too, going into the subway system.
He did. He did. After he made his first million in the South, he headed to New York, and that was about the turn of the century, 1902 or something. And he did a deal with the subways. There are several subway systems in New York, but he did deals with them. He also managed to run the newspaper kiosks in the subway stations because, of course, everybody going to work buys a newspaper to read on the train. And he sort of had a monopoly on newspaper kiosks. And he had gum machines, you know, that you put your, I suppose it's, in those days it was a penny, and got out a ball of gum or mm-hmm. a piece of chocolate.
Then somehow he ended up finding out about South Florida. How did he discover this area, going from Memphis to New York and all the big cities, and then this place where there was nothing at the time when he got here, almost nothing?
Well, he had a friend who owned streetcars in Chicago. And this man, John Roach, also owned the island of Yuseppa, which, of course, as you know, is off the coast of Fort Myers. Well, north of Pine Island. Anyway, John Roach invited Baron Collier to come and visit him on his island. And Baron Collier, as they say, he got sand in his shoes. He just fell in love with Florida. And he bought the island from John Roach, because by that time he had so much money, you know, he didn't know what to do with it. And he developed, Roach actually was taking in fishermen as guests. And so Collier developed the hotel, which was called the Tarpon Inn, because tarpon was a, trying to catch tarpon with a rod and reel was quite a big deal. And it had all started in 1885 when a man whose name I'll have to look up. Anyway, a man came down and caught a tarpon with a rod and reel off in St. Carlos Bay, off Punta Rossa. Mm-hmm. And so they knew that people who came to Yuseppa could go out and catch these big tarpon. So the Tarpon Inn actually had, and I haven't been across there in a while, but it used to be that if you caught a tarpon, they took one of the scales off, wrote your name and the weight of the tarpon and the date, and pinned it up on the wall in the inn.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and there are lovely old pictures of that. And there were prizes. The Isaac Walton Club presented prizes for the biggest tarpon. And amazingly, some of the people who caught them were women, and I'm sure that the women weighed less than the tarpon.
Wow. Yeah. That's bragging rights for sure. Now, is that, are the homes and the, are these places still there?
The inn is still there, and the Yuseppa Inn, and okay, you can go. Hurricane Charlie did a bit of damage, and I haven't been back, but I know that it is open, and there are a lot of cottages. Yuseppa is privately owned, so you have to get permission to go there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So now this kind of came about at a time when it seems like Southwest Florida was starting to kind of get on the map in the way of a getaway.
It was. That was 1911 when he bought Yuseppa Island, and he didn't really come back. Now, St. Petersburg and Fort Myers were fairly well settled, and of course we know Thomas Alva Edison came to Fort Myers in 1885 and brought his friend Henry Ford.
It kind of became a cool place to go to get away from everything.
Yeah, people would come for the winter because it was relaxing and it was warm. And I think there was a fair amount of culture, but it wasn't formal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is kind of a nice relief, you know, when you just, when you're trying to get away from everything, you don't want formal.
Yeah,
things.
And especially the stresses of work, like Edison, who had his lab in Fort Myers, and of course he could get away from business.
And get imaginative, you know, just kind of find inspiration.
And he and Ford would go out into the woods. They'd go to the Fakahatchee, for example, and the Big Cypress, and they were looking for plants to replace rubber. Because that was, well, they were worried about the supply of rubber, and they start growing all kinds of things. But that's that has nothing to do with Collier, so let me go back to the subject.
It's kind of hard not to think about all the different people that were so influential in not just our area, but the country and the world.
Yeah.
And they were here. They were here, there, around the turn of the century, and this is kind of where they wanted to be.
Yeah.
So did Baron Collier, was he kind of a year-round resident, or did he go back and forth?
No. He lived in New York and minded his business there, his advertising, of course. Mm-hmm. But he did come down for another visit to Florida. And his friend Roach, who had owned Yuseppa Island, had another friend named Langford, who was very important in Fort Myers. Langford started the bank, and he got the train to come here and so on. He was married to Edgar Watson's daughter, Carrie. Anyway, Langford and Roach owned a grapefruit farm in a place called Deep Lake. And Deep Lake is 13 miles north of what's now Everglades City. And Collier came down and had a look at the grapefruit farm in 1921-22. And he decided, oh, look at all this land and all the potential and how rich the soil is. And look at how big the grapefruits are growing. So he bought the farm. And then he just kept buying land.
You can't take this guy anywhere. He likes something and he buys it, right?
Yeah. And, well, actually, Langford died.
Oh, okay.
And so I think it was the Collier stepped in and said, well, I'll buy the farm.
Because he wanted to keep it going.
Yeah, and because I suppose he'd become quite friendly with Roach and Langford, and he knew that he could help out the family. But once he bought the farm, he kept buying more land until he had about 1 million acres, at least. And but there was no access when he came to do his first visit in Deep Lake. He went to Naples and got on a boat, and the captain actually wrote an article in the Fort Myers News Press about how they sailed all the way down to the little village of Everglade, and the family there, the Storter family, had an inn. They stopped and talked to the Storters, and then they took the train. Now, here's an interesting thing. To get the grapefruit from Deep Lake, which is inland, to the river in Everglades, which is quite big and could take sort of large ships, they built a rail track. And although we say a train, what they did was they used a Model T Ford or something, but they used special tires or special wheels so it would go on the rails. And the reason for using rail is that rather than try to build a road, rails smooth out the surface. Mm-hmm. So it's much easier to lay rails than to build a road.
Well, yeah, the case for building roads became kind of a big deal. And you mentioned the Model T and the cars. Yeah. And there's a funny story about them trying to do the Tamiami Trailblazers.
Yes.
Tell me a little about that. How'd that come up?
The Tamiami Trail had started before the First War, or around 1914, before America got into the war. And they wanted to build a road from Tampa to Miami. And the tax assessor in Miami, Frank Jordan, thought it was a great idea, and he owned land as well in South Florida, but closer to Miami. So he started to build the road, and he built it to the Dade County line. And the road started in Fort Myers, well, it went to Tampa, Fort Myers, and it got down around Naples, and the county commissioners in Lee County, which was in Fort, the seat was in Fort Myers, said, well, we're not going to put all this money in the swamp.
Yeah, so Lee County, that was what was there. There wasn't a Collier County yet.
There was
so
nothing.
Lee County didn't see the benefit of going that far
well,
south.
Well, it was very short-sighted because, of course, it would link the west and east coast.
Yeah.
But I mean, it could have been a political kind of thing, too. Anyway, so Collier said, well, I want this road going through my land because otherwise the land is useless. You know, it's hard to get to. So if you create a county for me, I'll find the finance for the road, because each county had to pay the expenses of the road going through its territory.
Oh, okay. So the county had to pick up the tab when there was a road going through.
Yeah.
All right.
And so a bill was put through the legislature in Tallahassee in May 1923, and Collier County was established, was formed. And Baron Collier, first of all, he bought out the little village of Everglades to use as his county seat, but also as his engineering headquarters. And he hired engineers, particularly David Graham Copeland, who was the chief engineer. And they start building this road. But before they built it, as you said, a group of, I think it was 23 men in 11 cars, Model T Fords, tried to go across the swamp. And they thought, oh, great, you know, we'll be the trailblazers. But it took them 3 weeks. They kept getting stuck. They kept having flat tires. They managed to get to Miami, but with difficulty.
I can't imagine the mosquito bites.
Well, don't even I'm sure they were dressed in netting as well.
Yeah, but that would just have been a tough drive. Three and a half weeks.
Something like 3 weeks, yeah.
Man, that's...
But, I mean, they were very proud. But, of course, what they proved is that you had to have a road. I mean, you couldn't get across there. Even if instead of Maltese, if they'd taken oxen, it would have taken that long.
Exactly. It would have been tough. You know, I think a lot of people might be surprised to know that Everglades City was the original seat of the county.
Oh, yes.
But yeah. That got moved after Hurricane Donna?
It got moved officially before that. There was a referendum in 1959.
Oh, okay.
Because by that time, the population had moved to Naples. So, and they decided that East Naples was going to be where the new county seat was. And East Naples isn't a city, of course, but they created a government center there. And then, of course, Hurricane Donna didn't help. It just vindicated all the votes
that wanted
said,
to move.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Well, of course, we've just had a hurricane, but Donna was worse.
Well, I remember talking to a county commissioner, and she said now it kind of makes sense. She said the county seat got moved after around the time of Hurricane Donna, yeah. And this is kind of a reminder of why that was not necessarily a bad move.
Yes.
So we've talked all about the story of how Collier County came to be.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you feel like you wanted to write this down, and especially with a younger audience as the target?
Well, okay. It started with a friend of mine who's a historian in Marco Island. And he said, why don't you write about Baron Collier? Because I just finished another book. And I thought, no, I've done enough. You know, writing books it's not hard. It's fun, but it takes a bit of effort.
And attention span. You know, you have to be into the subject and stay on it and try not to get...
Well, I tell people when I'm working, I'm in the wrong century, don't talk to me. Yeah, because most of the things I'm writing about are 100 years ago. But what I discovered, and of course my friend the historian knew this, is that Baron Collier did a lot more than just found Collier County. He owned a shipping line in Fort Myers. He owned telephone network in southern Florida. He had a bus line, which was called Tamiami Trail Tours. But then he started buying hotels, and he bought two hotels in Tampa. He had the hotel in Port Charlotte. He had the Gasparilla Inn on Boca Grande. He had two hotels in West Palm Beach, and he had two in Miami. And he sort of dominated commerce in a way.
And not just Collier County, but it's all of
South
Florida, pretty
much. No,
this
was all over. And of course, I didn't know that. There are two hotels, or there were, down in Everglades, the Rod and Gun, which is famous, mm-hmm. and then the Inn, which burnt down, in 1987. But some of his original hotels, and of course, the Yuseppa Inn, the Tarpon Inn, but some of his original hotels are still going. The Gasparilla Inn is still going in Boca Grande.
Are there still Colliers among us?
Do we
have descendants still in the area?
Baron Collier married a gal from Memphis, and they married in 1907, after he made enough money. And they had three boys. The oldest was Baron Collier Jr., and then there was Sam and Miles. And Sam and Miles were really into car racing, and they imported MG sports cars from England. They lived, the family had a sort of estate up in New York in the country. Mm-hmm. And they lived, they would take go-karts and go around as kids around this estate instead of riding horses like most kids do. And so they helped to start the Watkins Glen car racing and did a whole bunch of stuff. Anyway, unfortunately, Sam died in a crash in 1948 and during a race. And Miles died of a virus in 1954. And nobody knows, it might have been a rare form of polio, mm-hmm. but whatever it was in 1954, it was untreatable. So the only one left was Baron Jr. But Miles and Sam both had children, had both married by that time. So there's an extensive Collier family, and there are two companies that are run by the Colliers, and they still own a lot of land.
here in the in the county named after their
well, mostly in Collier patron. County. Yeah.
It's funny listening to you talk about these people in history because it sounds like you're talking about family members. When you're researching these things, how do you find this information? How do you get to know them? And do you kind of feel like they're sort of family?
I really would love to have talked to Baron Collier, but that's obviously not going to happen. I do a lot of my research online, and I'm sure that I couldn't have done anything, say, 20 years ago. I would have been stuck in libraries digging around in old card files, and it would have taken years and years and years. But now it's fairly easy to research online, and there's the News Press, for example, is on a website, and you can download anything from it, you know, old issues. And if you've got the patience to do a search. And the Florida State Archives have a wonderful photo collection, and they allow you to use it as long as you give them credit. So I use a lot of their photos in my books.
Well, photos help tell a story, especially with younger readers, too.
Well, it's that one's for younger readers, but in fact, it started out as one for adults.
But so this would target maybe middle schoolers, middle school or high school?
I would say that the target for my younger readers is kids do history in fourth grade.
Okay.
So it's hard to tell whether they can read it or not. You know, kids develop so fast.
And all different kids are different levels, right?
So some of them at the age of 10 or 11 will have no trouble reading it, and others won't. But the very first of my kids' books was one of my neighbors, when I was writing an adult book, couldn't understand all the big words.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, I'll just write it in simple English. And that one was about Everglades City. And in fact, there was a gal who came from South America, and she was trying to learn English. And I asked her to translate it for me. And she took the kids' version of my book
mm-hmm.
and could translate that into Spanish because it was in what I call simple English.
And tell me a little bit about the other books that you've written. You've done a number of books about our surrounding area.
Well, the first one I did was the book about Everglades City. And I did that because when I moved there, I went to volunteer in the museum, and I didn't know anything about the city. So I start reading, and so I could, well, I was a sort of a docent, I suppose. I greeted people. And I just kept reading and reading as much as I could. And eventually I had so much material, I had to write a book, or I had to write something to get it straight in my own mind.
Mm-hmm. So get it organized, right?
Yeah. That was the first book, The Brief History of Everglades City. And that was in 2001.
And then you went to Sanibel?
And I had, in fact, the family had a condo in Sanibel, even before I went to Everglades City. And I'd haunted their library, because the Sanibel Public Library has shelves of wonderful history books. So I'd done a lot of research even before I moved to Everglades City. And when I finished the Everglades book, I thought, maybe I ought to work on the Sanibel book as well.
You're like, I've got all the Sanibel stuff rattling around in my brain.
Yeah. Well, they're connected. I mean, and which is, I don't know how much time we've got, but there was a man who farmed from Key West, who farmed on Sanibel, and he was going back to Key West, and his boat got, he needed supplies, and he went up the river in Everglades City, and he founded Everglades City. Mm-hmm. So there's actually a Sanibel-Everglades connection. So, yes, I wrote the brief history of Sanibel Island, and then I thought, oh, I guess I better do the kids' version as well.
Yeah. It's great. It's really good information for locals, and the fact that we have so many people who aren't locals that have moved here from somewhere else that want to learn about where their new home is.
Well, that's why I started in the first place, is because I wanted to learn. And I had to, you know, I didn't have Florida history when I was a kid in Connecticut.
Yeah.
So I had to learn about, you know, the Spanish coming here and all that
and
stuff.
And it's definitely, it's unique. It's a unique history from a lot of other parts. Well, I want to thank you for coming in and talking with us.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
It's been really fun learning. Marya Repko, the book is The Story of Baron Collier. It's a history for young readers. That's the latest from your personally created library. So I want to thank you for putting that together and for talking with us about it today.
Okay. If listeners are interested, I do have a website.
Okay.
And it's ecity-publishing.com.
.com. Gotcha.
Because eCity, of course, is Everglades City.
Yeah, and we will have links to that on our website, which is wgcunews.org, in case you didn't happen to remember that or get that scribbled down. But we do have a link to that on this story on wgcunews.org. So thanks for coming in.
Okay, you're more than welcome.
Our show today was produced by Rachel Iacovone and Mike Canary. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.